Okay, hello everybody.
Hello, Linda.
I'm really happy to do this call tonight with Dr. Day. Wonderful man, known him for many years. He's been involved with Designs for Health for quite a few years and basically knows us from attending our many seminars. And Dr. Day received his medical degree from Tulane University in 1977. Then he completed his residency training in surgery at the University of Maryland in 1981. So for 20 years, he practiced general and vascular surgery in Boulder, Colorado, where he now resides. And there he served as chairman of the Department of Surgery for 2 years. Based on what he learned from breast cancer patients, Dr. Day founded the Halen Lifestream Center in Boulder, Colorado. He developed a heart-based health model, exploring the connection between emotional health and physical health, and he assists clients in the evolving of life processes, combining body, mind, emotional, spirit, and looking at bioenergy and systems and bioidentical hormones, which we're going to hear all about tonight. So, Dr. Day, thanks for joining us from Colorado.
Thank you, Linda, for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Good. We're happy to have you. Dr. Day, you come from a family of medical doctors. Tell us about how this has had an impact on what you're doing today.
Well, my parents were both doctors. My father was a surgeon. My mother was an internist. Unfortunately, they split up when I was 4 years old, and I lived with the mother in Alabama. And she had a very formative experience, or a very formative influence on me in many ways. And one of the things that used to happen in the early days of my life was that I would accompany her on rounds to the hospitals, to people's homes, and I would go in the car with her and go into these places. And once in the car, I asked her if she'd ever saved anyone's life. I just had to know this because the whole concept was somewhat fascinating to me. And her comment was, "No, God does that." And that's all she said. And so I kept that in silence. And those words actually were the only medical teaching she ever gave me. She never taught me anything else about medicine from her personal or practical experience. And then as the years went by, I found myself in medical school. And during the medical school training and during the surgical training, there was never any mention of spirit. So her teaching was the only teaching that I ever got about spiritual issues related to human healing. And so my quest in medical school and thereafter became one that involves finding out more about this, because I think it was the real, I think it's the real essence of healing, and that's what we'll talk about tonight. So in the surgical work, I began to study different Eastern paths and more mystical or esoteric matters related to the Christian path, which was the way I was brought up through Episcopalianism. And I shifted my consciousness into learning about the Eastern paths and the similarities that Eastern paths have to the mystical Christian teachings. And so when one studies the Eastern paths, you can't help but study their culture and their healing traditions, because in these paths, the healing and the spirituality are one and the same. That's very different than it is in Western science and medicine. So my mother had this kind of influence on me. She put this seed in me, and it grew. And eventually, through the surgical work, which was, I describe as a grand distraction, a very necessary one in my life, for 24 years I studied human disease and tried to understand it through my emerging spiritual consciousness, which was founded in that time in various schools of yoga. So the heart-based model literally was generated out of one particular patient at a point where my information base was allowed me to generate this particular model that I call Halen Lifestream, which is based in heart consciousness, or the longest journey that we will all ever take, which is the journey from brain-mind to heart-mind.
Well, your mother was also the medical doctor to a very famous person that we all learned about when we were kids, probably about maybe a little older than you were the age when you asked your mother if she had ever saved anybody. So tell us about this.
Well, my mother was actually the physician to family members of Helen Keller, who was an Alabama native. And Miss Keller would visit our hometown from time to time, and she actually had a fairly intimate friendship with my mother. And so one day, my mother picked up my sister Margaret and my brother Robert and I and took us over to meet Miss Keller. I was 9 years old, and this was in 1960. Miss Keller was passed on in 1968. And so I got to meet this radiant being and experience her and talk with her, and she talked back to us. She also used a translator. Ann Sullivan had passed on at that time. It was a very wonderful experience, and I would say at age 9, I tracked most of this development back to Miss Keller at age 9, and then my mother put this other seed in me at about age 12, and then I began to become more interested in the healing ministry of Christ, which went on into other teachings as time went on. But the Helen Keller experience was, yes, a very, very important event in my life. I like to think some of her angels jumped off on me at some point and guided me along.
Wouldn't be surprised. Now, I know that there's a lot of people online tonight, Dr. Day, that have listened to 10, 20, 30, maybe more of these clinical rounds calls week after week, and this is a very different topic from, you know, what we've typically discussed. And the reason that that I thought important is that, you know, first of all, I got to experience what you do as a patient of yours. And, you know, in today's era where everything is computer-oriented and we're in a very high-tech era, I just really wonder how many of us as healers are not paying attention to intuition and the connection to our own core or our energy systems or our patient's energy systems and maybe their emotions. And, you know, we diagnose with tests and then we give supplements to simply fix them.
Well, I call that the realm of doing. And we're a lot of times in healing work, we're doing things. That is, we're looking to the outside of ourselves for healing. And then there's another realm called the realm of being that involves more of the healing of trauma in our mental and emotional world and the development of truth, self-love, and spiritual concepts. So, but the realm of doing, the nutrition and the exercise and the healing in the body, physical proper, is really a very important part of spirituality, and I hope to discuss this as our time goes on tonight. Try to develop this concept. Some of these concepts that I'll refer to may seem slightly esoteric, but they're becoming more and more supported by current Western science, which involves string field theory, holography. We're sort of in the post-quantum age, and now we're moving more from relativity and quantum mechanics into string field theory. And so it'll involve some of that. There's some information about fractal geometry and how that relates to the energy field. So,
good time for us to talk about the Halen life stream model. Have you
that's a good
that?
Time. I'll explain the terminology. It's kind of unusual terminology. Even the word Halen, H-A-E-L-A-N, is a root word from Old English, and it's the root word that the words heal, whole, holy, and holistic all come from. So that's pretty straightforward. Lifestream is a little bit more, or a little bit less straightforward. I chose the word lifestream carefully some years ago when I developed this model to try to encompass an understanding of both horizontal time and vertical time. Vertical time is not something people commonly or colloquially talk about. But so let's talk about horizontal time for a minute. This refers to past, present, and future. It refers to getting to a now-based existence, which I define as just practicing principles of personal authenticity inside of just one day at a time. So it's practicing being John and Linda on Wednesday, for instance. That's the best we can do until we refine that process. Usually because of our holding of past trauma, we let the past inform the now. But we can inform ourselves by who we are becoming, not by who we've been. And so now we shift to vertical time, And this concept was first introduced into Western thought by Dr. Hugh Everett III, who was a quantum physicist. And he introduced this concept in 1957. It was not well received by his peers, but now it's being strongly supported through the multidimensional aspects that we're beginning to sort of theorize about through string theory. So in 1957, he introduced this concept in which he said that there are many layers of time in parallel universes. And he said that they're choice points in which we never are locked into one particular outcome. And so, therefore, conceptually, we could envision that we're already healed. We already own that, and that peace exists in our world and is present within an understanding of vertical time. This correlates well with what the ancient Essene Gnostic said, that the most powerful moment in our day is the moment between the inhalation and the exhalation, or the exhalation and the inhalation of a breath. And this moment in between is a space where nothing happens, and it opens the door to all possibilities. My spiritual teacher back when I was a surgical resident was Swami Muktananda. He passed on in 1982, and he used to talk to us about the concept called the gap, or the still point in between thoughts and the still point in between the breath. And he talked about this long before Deepak Chopra and Wayne Dyer ever started talking about it and made it a more common teaching in these circles. So in linear time, the past continues to claim the present and informs who we are. And a possible solution to this might be to step into vertical time, or conceptualize it at least. And the shaman people, the shaman tradition, honors this as a reality that they call sacred time. Sacred time turns like a wheel where we can heal events that have occurred in the past, where we can inform ourselves by who we are becoming, not by who we've been. And so in sacred time, there's really no time. It doesn't exist. Everything is kind of occurring at the same time. Einstein tried to puzzle this conundrum by stating that the purpose of time is so that everything doesn't happen at once. That's actually a statement of vertical time. In this time, we drop in between the moments through the practice of stillness. This is meditative stillness, meditative prayer, becoming heart conscious. It's when the brain mind stops all that there is and we enter the more sacred time that exists in each of us in the sacred silence of heart mind. And so the Sanskrit term for heart mind in the energy system, or the Sanskrit term for the heart chakra, the heart center, is anahata, which means unstruck sound. So this life stream terminology refers to a stream of vertical sacred time choice points. And I don't commonly share that with clients, but I do explore it with some clients. And for the first time last week, a client came in and she related to me that she thinks of time in a vertical fashion, and she drew her arm up and down in a vertical way. And I thought that was very striking. The concept basically boils down to row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. And we try to shift our awareness to get from one stream to a new stream of our choice. And by so doing, we sort of claim the experience that we want for ourselves and our families and our communities and our world. And so that's the concept of life stream. The question that comes out of this concept is, what outcomes have you been predicting for your life that may be locking you into experiences that are not in your best interest? So the model is a study. The listener can imagine a pyramid, an equilateral triangle divided into six layers, and one layer supporting the next and rising in a hierarchical fashion. The first layer, the base layer, is nutrition. And nutrition is more than what we feed our body. It's really what we feed our life, most particularly self-love and healing. And it refers to forms of nutrition such as air, sunlight, water, food, and then a fifth form of nutrition that the Eastern people call prana or chi, which feeds the chakra elements and is metabolized through the chakras. The next layer up is exercise, then mental and emotional clarity or peace. The fourth layer is self-love. The fifth layer is spiritual awareness, and the top layer is vision work. And then the triangle is encircled with a circle joining the three points of the triangle representing sacred time and the unity of the seventh chakra. So the model becomes a study of the aspects of healing in body, mind, emotion, and spirit. And so healing in the body might be about alleviating symptom states. It might be about alleviating disease states. A disease is not seen as anything other than the beginning of a healing process. It's sort of like our reference point to where we are with our healing. And healing in the body might be about developing an anti-aging program. It might be about developing a better exercise program, flexibility, aerobics, strength training, and these types of things. Healing in the mind is referencing the proper union of brain-mind and heart-mind, or getting to the point where the brain serves the heart rather than the left brain dominating the heart. And the teaching that I work with people around is breaking this lethal covenant of the left hemisphere, literally overpowering and grinding down the message of the heart to where it's indecipherable, and therefore our traumas never heal. So healing in the mind is about shifting attitudes and beliefs that inhibit creativity. That's one way of saying that. Healing in the emotion world is about not judging our emotion states. It's about allowing ourselves to listen to the emotions that come up, what are the feeling states associated with them, and using the emotions as the tools that they're properly designed for, which is protection and healing in the life. So I work with 9 key emotional states that we'll come to in a bit when we get to the emotional discussion. And these 9 key emotional states are divided into 2 groups, 6 particular emotions, which can be driven into shadow form by the workings of guilt and shame, which is essentially trauma. And then 3 emotional states that don't have any shadow terminology associated with them, but are repressed because we don't understand our primary motivators and the peak experiences of joy that are heart-based. And then finally, healing in the spiritual aspect. From my perspective, it's neither denominational, it's not agnostic, it's not atheist. I would explain spirituality as an evolution and healing of body, mind, and emotions into the central organizing intelligence of the human being, which is the heart. And the largest aspect of this healing involves understanding how our individual traumas are memoried into our being and are rekindled or are re-triggered by daily traumatic stress events. As a result, we tend to express our judgment of self and others through negativity of emotional states, never using the emotional states for what they were intended, and oftentimes repressing or suppressing the emotion state down back into the inner world that it came from. So the journey of healing is sort of a journey from the noisy, chattering brain-mind to the more silent, knowing heart-mind. And I think all spiritual masters, at least the ones that I've studied, have acknowledged this sort of know-thyself journey in one way or another. And the different schools of science, the Western science, are now depicting cosmology as a non-local, multidimensional process holographically organized in our being as self or divine consciousness, also now called, especially by the Western quantum people and the string theorists, they simply call this the mind of God. I'm reminded of the Persian poet who said, "Thinkest thyself a puny form when within thee the whole universe is enfolded." So these great traditions of the world acknowledge that the world around us is a mirror of what we have become within, both individually and collectively. It is a holographic mirror of our internal experience. Western science acknowledges that there's a field of intelligent energy that links these aspects of creations, and our thoughts and our feelings work through this field. So it becomes very important to know our thoughts and feelings in the context of our belief structures and the attitudes that we carry into our world. So we each then are sort of a universal, multidimensional hologram of the cosmos, which is quite a mouthful. I would say William Blake said it even better, the 19th century poet and mystic, when he said that God became as we are that we may become as God is. And then the holographic mirroring becomes the way to bring about change in the outer world, and that is to bring about change in, within ourselves. Or as Gandhi said, we must be the change that we wish to see in the world. So we should become in our lives the very thing that we want to see mirrored back into the world around us. So that's a kind of a rough end of this model. Now what we could do is kind of go through the layers, because I think there's some things that I'd like to say as to how I work with nutrition and exercise, because this sometimes involves the use of supplements, nutritional supplements, and we're talking tonight to a lot of nutritionists. I'd also like to talk a little bit about how I like to work with food.
We would like you to share that, John. That would be great.
Okay. We'll start with the nutrition level and kind of work up briefly, and I want to bring in some things about the studies of DNA that came out in the 1990s and talk a little bit about the bioenergy field. So with the food piece, food being the best medicine, as Hippocrates used to say, I like Loren Cordain's Paleolithic diet, and I recommend his book, The Paleo Diet. And he has seven principles, the principles being to eat a relatively high amount of animal protein as compared to the usual typical American diet, to eat fewer carbs, to eat higher quality of fat, which means more omega-3 and omega-6 fats, to eat higher amount of fiber, to get a higher potassium loading relative to sodium, to eat more of an alkaline loading, and then to eat foods that are very rich in phytochemicals, antioxidants, vitamin minerals, and the such. And so instead of trying to explain all of that to people, I break those 7 points down into 4 key points. So I'll say to use foods that are rich in calcium, magnesium, and zinc, and I provide a list for people to look at what these foods are. And these foods ordinarily are very high in potassium. And ordinarily, the typical listing of foods that are rich in calcium and magnesium and zinc have sort of a 60 to 70% alkaline loading. So it's about 60 to 70% alkaline versus 30 to 40% acid. And so that's kind of how I handle that. And I try to move people more toward alkalinity, at least the typical kinds of diseases that I work with, say osteoporosis or cancer or diabetes and inflammatory conditions, et cetera, of both blood vessels and joints and so forth. So alkalinity seems to help that. So it's easy to say, point number one, eat calcium, magnesium, but zinc-rich foods. Eat a diet that's predominantly alkaline, that is, draw a plate, a circle, and split it into about 60 to 70% of the things that go onto that plate are alkaline in nature, and the other 30, 40% on the other side is acid. So the acid is typically where we get most of our protein. So the third thing I do is break down for people, say, 1 gram of protein per kilogram of body weight per day. I use that as kind of a rough tool. If they're more active and are marathoning, for instance, they get more protein, and we go over what the protein content is of foods. So the other thing that comes in, the fourth principle, is where he says eat foods that are rich in phytochemicals and vitamins and minerals and antioxidants. I say just eat a rainbow diet. That is, eat a diet that is going to cover the colors of the rainbow every day. In fact, eat those colors every day. So we don't get too many blue foods, but there is one good one, and it's blueberries, and it's very high in ORAC. So we can use blueberries in our morning drinks. We can throw in paleo meal. We can throw in paleo greens. And that becomes a pretty nice alkaline loading, realizing, of course, that some people would say that blueberries are slightly acid. So those 4 points, the way I do the Loren Cordain paleo diet is through those types of points. With supplements, I think it's important to consider supplements with this kind of diet, because of the way our stress is in our world, and because of the way our environment is, and because of the way that the food industry has become. I believe that nutrition is a very important aspect of spirituality, because it's through nutrition that we're going to be able to supply the brain with the kinds of things that are going to allow it to be nourished and balanced in its most important chemical function and structural components. It's more likely, if it's not balanced in these important biochemical molecular ways, it's more likely that a brain circuitry is going to stay stuck running off of old circuits as just reentry patterns or little seizures, which is what trauma sometimes amounts to. And so we're repeatedly triggered on a daily basis around unresolved trauma. And if we can nourish the brain element, then we might have a good chance. And I approach brain nourishment through neurohormones, particularly sex steroid hormones. I talk a lot about pregnenolone, DHEA, progesterone, testosterone, and the three estrogens, and help people with blendings and formulations along this line. I work with the brain elements around the aspects of the four basic neurochemical pathways of brain transmitters, the dopamine system, the acetylcholine system, the GABA-aminobutyric acid system, and the serotonin system. And there are many supplements that are plug right into these pathways. So tyrosine, for instance, to enhance dopamine production, 5-HTP to enhance serotonin, omega-3 fatty acids, and so forth. So one can learn about that. You had Dr. Braverman on some weeks ago. He gave a very good description of this, and you can pick up his book, The Edge Effect, which I know Linda's a big fan of, and learn more about this. And so the other aspect of the brain health that I like to nourish is the mitochondria. And my mitochondrial formulas look like carnitine, CoQ10, omega-3 fatty acids, magnesium, lipoic acid, and B vitamins, and then carnosine for the anti-glycating effect. So that particular grouping of supplements that I just sort of went through sort of works all through the body, not just for the brain, of course, but for the whole body, because we need those mitochondria to be in good health, and we need that maternal DNA in the mitochondria to be expressing the right proteins. So that's a little bit about my philosophy about nutrition. It depends, of course, upon the individual and looking at what it is that they're eating that they shouldn't be eating and what they're not eating that they should be eating. And then in the exercise aspect, I try to move people into the important components, aerobic conditioning, endurance conditioning, that is, lean muscle mass building, strengthening the system, strengthening the musculoskeletal system so that it burns energy more efficiently and so that it's more resistant to accidents and injuries. Flexibility is very important. I like the yoga systems. I like the system of exercises called the Five Tibetans, which is five Tibetan exercises. These five particular exercises were given by Tibetan lamas to a British colonel back in the early part of last century and were published, and they do a very nice job of improving core muscular strength, not unlike Pilates, but also activating the chakras for an anti-aging effect. And I sometimes tell people that the use of these five Tibetans, which is be difficult to describe over the phone, these five Tibetan postures might obviate the need for a lot of health clubs, but be that as it may. The other part of exercise is balance. That becomes more important as we age. So exercise is also really a concept of how flexible are we in our life? How much endurance do we have to deal with life stresses and life's traumas and life's heartaches? Okay, talking too much here. All right, let's move up to the mental and emotional. These six layers are oriented around chakras, which will sort of blend into this discussion as we discuss the energy field. So the nine key emotional states,
John, you're going in and out a little bit. Kevin, can you hear him right now?
Am I back?
You're back now.
Okay. The 9 key emotional states that I like to work with are apathy, grief, fear, desire, anger, pride, courage, acceptance, and peace. The first 6 have a fairly strong shadow language, or a lot of synonyms that we use in our inner lexicon of speaking that are related to the guilting and shames that we took on in the world, the inner child. I work with people around understanding the wounds of the inner child, that is, the types of adult behaviors that we display as a result of woundings that occurred during the time when we were an infant, a toddler, a preschooler, and a school-aged child. During those times, we were to have developed the major ego strengths of hope, willpower, purpose, and competence. And we go through certain types of ego structuring in this time, and traumas are very common in this time. So we talk a lot about trauma. We talk about trauma from the aspect of major trauma, which would be common categories that everybody would recognize as obvious causes of trauma, such as war or severe childhood emotional, physical, or sexual abuse, or experiencing or witnessing violence or rape or assault or catastrophic injuries, loss of a loved one. Everybody would say that that's true trauma and agree on that. And then there are a list of more potentially traumatizing occurrences that may not be so obvious, such as fetal trauma or intrauterine trauma. There's now a whole new science of perinatal and intrauterine trauma that's being developed and is emerging that I could share with the listeners if we want to get to that in the question and answer period. Other potentially traumatizing occurrences might be birth trauma, abandonment, illnesses like with high fever, invasive medical or dental procedures, and the anesthesia that goes with them, or children being immobilized by casting and splinting, or even being immobilized inside of a playpen, sudden loud noises, and so forth. And so the trauma evokes in the being typical kinds of reactions to these overwhelming events, and the core of the traumatic reaction becomes a chemical one, hyperarousal, followed by constriction, followed by some form of dissociation or denial. And we do the dissociation because it's sort of a common means of enduring experiences that are, for the moment, beyond endurance. It's what happens when an animal is chased down in the wild and is brought down by the predator. The animal dissociates so that the problem of being eaten alive is not so unpleasant. But on some occasions, as has been observed in nature, the animal is allowed to survive. Maybe the predator got chased away. And so the dissociated animal has to reassociate inside of its physical being, which means it has to reintegrate the aspects of its autonomic nervous system and reintegrate its sympathetic and parasympathetic systems. The animal does that very well by completing the arousal response, but humans don't. We tend to repress this into a denial form. It requires lower levels of energy, basically. And then we basically memory the trauma. We have not completed the trauma event. And these trauma events, as I alluded to earlier, can come in many different types of forms. But they essentially lead to feelings of helplessness, immobility, or freezing inside of the life. Then there's sort of a list of early symptoms of trauma that I work through with people versus symptoms that occur in the person's life in later stages of development and then yet later stages of final groupings of symptoms. So we work through this to understand sort of a trauma history, a little itinerary of what types of events the person is still holding or memorying in their cellular and in their energetic form. Try to help people move into first kind of a conscious awareness and then moving into the essence of healing, which involves, for most of us, forgiveness, or just the ability to see the pure essence of our own being and the pure essence of another being. Well, the nine key emotional states, apathy, grief, fear, desire, anger, and pride, and then courage, acceptance, and peace, are really the tools that we've been allowed in the human form to deal with the essence of our life. And these feeling states and emotion states come into our thought world, and the thought world then influences the words that we have in our head, and the words that we have in our head influence the actions that we take in our life, and those actions become our habits, and these habits form our character, and this becomes ultimately our destiny. It's like I was referring back to when I was talking about the vertical time experience. We have belief structures and choice points along the way that continue to create this karmic wheel of activity. And somewhere we have to break into this through the healing of trauma. And this requires oftentimes some guidance and some type of therapeutic intervention or talking to someone who knows how to move people past the trauma into the reassociation and reintegration of their autonomic nervous system, out of the dysautonomia, out of these wild swings of parasympathetic and sympathetic activity, and into the more profound aspects of self-love. A key point of the mental and emotional level is the development of the meditation process, some type of meditation process. It can be standing meditation, walking meditation, lying down meditation, or sitting meditation. But it always will involve aspects of developing the relaxation response, that is the reintegration of the vagus nerve and the parasympathetic tone in the body through proper breathing techniques, the development of witness consciousness about our internal process. We have to be able to observe our own internal process with a non-judgmental attitude. We have to be able to just see our thoughts, witness our thoughts, not run away from them, not push the emotions and feelings away, but learn to have a witness consciousness. And then finally, the development of mindfulness. So mindfulness becomes not where the mind is full of thoughts, that is, the brain-mind is full of thoughts. That's not the idea. We're actually more heart-mind full of silence, and then the wisdom comes. Now, the wisdom piece that I refer to blends into the next layer, which is self-love. So self-love is about this journey to the heart. And we acknowledge the heart's neuromuscular pumping power and its electromechanical features in addition to its essential function as a central intelligence that can lift us beyond these problems and into a new experience, these vertical choice points. We have to get to a now time existence where the past is not continually informing our present. So the heart-mind consciousness fosters more intuitive wisdom, a clearer perception, mental and emotional genius, if you will, and we become more true to our spiritual essence. In this layer, I work with people to identify key moments of joy or peak experience that they've had, pick a grouping of them that are important ones, and define the essence of this. What was the essence of this experience for the individual? And then we define from a listing or grouping of so-called jobs, J-O-B. These are more generic descriptions of what are called primary motivators. And the essence of the moment of joy has to match the primary motivator. And then we work with a grouping of these, practicing creating a spiritual statement or a vision work statement around this. So the spiritual issue then becomes, how do we develop our true authentic passions? And then how do we bring this forward and share it with the world? So the other aspect of the heart is a recognition of its electromagnetic power, which has been measured in superquantum interference devices, or SQUID magnetometers. It's a specially acoustically shielded room. The first one of these measurements was done in Denver. And the heart's electromagnetic energy pulse is the largest pulse that extends about a 12-foot diameter around the body. But that's probably just the limitation of the squid. If we believe in multidimensional quantum cosmos, then really the heart's energy field is everywhere because everything is supposedly encoded holographically within it. Now, curiously, the second strongest energy field emanation from a human being after the heart is the eyes. So the eyes transmit energy. They transmit quantum packets of information or intentionality. So I have people conceptualize and work with the notions of practicing with their main vibrational elements, which is their heart vibration, their voice or their word, and the intention that they transmit through their eyes. So a common practice would be to look at yourself in the mirror and not shirk away from what you see, but to intentionally transmit love to that image. And as you transmit love to that image in the mirror, so we also learn to transmit love into the image of the mirror of the world that we're walking around and existing in. The quantum mirror of the world then projects that back to us. That's one of our choice points. So we have a fear of letting go, and we create a reality to retain our limits. And so we often are defined by these restrictions and resistances that we placed on ourselves. I think we could define a human state as how much resistance we do to our life process. So I have a little formula that I work with people, and this little formula is not an algebraic equation, but it's D times FS times V has to be greater than R. So D is dissatisfaction, V is vision, and then FS are first steps. So our dissatisfaction level leads us to our vision piece, our spiritual essence, defined out of heart. And then we take the first steps. And that has to be greater than our resistance pattern. The resistance pattern could be essentially defined as the demons of the four chakras, the demons of the seven chakras, those being from chakra one up through chakra seven, these energy centers that are arranged along the spine. The simplest way to do this in the time remaining is to know the demons of the chakras and to not sort of run away from them, because they all essentially indicate some type of trauma that's memoried in the field. So the demons would be fear, guilt, shame, grief, lies, illusions, and attachments, respectively, for chakras 1 through 7. So that's not the exact kind of description of the energy field that I wanted to give, and so I'm just going to spend another minute on that and see if you have any questions, Linda, and see where we want to go from here into the listeners' questions or what. The human energy field, when I was a surgeon, I could open up an abdomen, but, you know, obviously we wouldn't be seeing chakras inside of the abdomen. But if I had a fine-tuning device somewhere up on my right prefrontal cortex, maybe I could change my frequency to a higher level of vision where I could see these types of energy emanations. And the rest of the energy field is somewhat like that. It consists of sort of a combination of different phenomena, and we would describe infinite multidimensional lines of force which create this field and impinge through finer or more dense layers. The layers becoming more dense as we approach the body. And our true essence, which is soul, sort of uses this mechanism and slows its vibrational intensity through stages so that we'll be able to integrate with the physical body without burning it up, literally. The chakras would be seen as sort of step-down transformer units of this type of energy. As these layers of the subtle energy envelop and interpenetrate the body, they become slower and become denser as we approach physical proximity. And some people say that there are four layers, the spiritual, the mental, and the emotional, and the physical, and other people say there are seven layers. But whatever the case may be, the predominant function of the subtle body sheaths is to sort of help coordinate and regulate the soul's activities in physical life. So the aspect that is important here, I think, is that the interfaces between these subtle sheaths, these fine density layers that become more dense as we approach the physical body, this important fact is that the interfaces between these subtle body sheaths are arranged fractally. That means they can be dimensionally infinite. And that's an important concept because that allows for the holography of the organization of this quantum field within our own energy field. So all the DNA, all the cellular activity, all the organs, all the emotions, all the mental activity and the chakras themselves, as well as divine source and soul, are organized holographically in our being. In fact, as the ancient traditions and as the Western the Western theorists are now saying, the entire cosmology is organized in our being. So the meridians then are also a part of this system, and they would be called the rivers of light by the shaman people. They really form the physical body matrix, and they're just the top, just on the surface of the body, forming its matrix. The meridians that most frequently get shocked out of correct frequency by trauma triggers would be the lung meridian around sense of loss, the heart meridian around anger, the kidney meridian around sexual oppression and sexual issues, the bladder meridian around conflicts, the spleen meridian around anxiety, and the pericardium around holding on to the past. The chakras are therefore in this field seen as the wheels of light. So we have these aspects, the meridians, the chakras, the subtle sheaths of the body, the physical body itself, and all of these emanations. And so the body also puts out light, electrical, thermal, sound, magnetic, and electromagnetic force. So there's these things to consider as well. That description doesn't do justice to the energy system, but I found that the energy system and understanding the traumas of the chakras corresponds very well to understanding the traumas of the inner child and how these get re-triggered in the adult by just typical daily adult experience. And I find that the bioenergy system and an understanding of the chakras is a very good place to integrate all of these aspects of body, mind, emotion, and spirit. And so I've gotten to where I can't think without it. Now, those are the things that I'd like to say. We didn't get to DNA, but we can talk about it for a minute if the audience wants.
Yeah, we can do that.
Are we still together?
Yep.
Okay.
We got a few more minutes, and then we'll open for questions.
All right. Well, in the 1990s, some people started experimenting around DNA. The first experiment was called the DNA phantom effect. It occurred in the early 90s by a Russian named Vladimir Popanin, who was a quantum biologist in the Russian Academy of Science. The Russian Academy of Science is the highest science organization in the Soviet Union, or in Russia. And what Popanin did was he created a vacuum in a glass tube, and then he observed in the tube randomly scattered photons. Then he placed DNA in the tube, and the photons abandoned their random pattern and aligned along the DNA axis. The next thing he did was he removed the DNA from the tube, and the photons remained ordered as if the DNA were still there. The conclusion of this would be that through some kind of field of energy, human DNA has some type of direct effect on matter, or at least on wave-particle duality in our world. Excuse me. The next experiment a few years later was from the Heart Math Institute, who has given us a lot of the very good teachings about how to get into heart consciousness through Western technology. And these researchers, Glenn Ryan and Roland McCready, reported in the Psychotronics Conference in Milwaukee in 1993 a paper entitled Local and Non-Local Effects of coherent heart frequencies on conformational changes of DNA. What they did in this particular experiment was select a group of people trained to generate coherent emotions at will, such as love or understanding or compassion and appreciation. And then in these, they took DNA from the donor and then observed in measurements of the DNA that when the donor was able to generate these coherent love-based emotions, that the twin strands of DNA relaxed and elongated. When the donor, on the other hand, was able to generate fear-based emotions, such as anger or hatred or jealousy, the DNA strands were seen to tighten and shorten in the measurements. And they also were able to observe that DNA, when relaxed, was in a better state to encourage immune function and healing. And so the conclusion is, from this one, was that our feelings and emotions have a direct effect on DNA, which goes back to the quantum hologram piece, and how our feelings and emotion states become the way we would pray. So we would talk about prayer from the standpoint of colloquial prayer and petitionary prayer and ritualistic prayer and meditative prayer, but the fifth form of prayer is really the coherent feeling states that we use in the form of prayer, such that when we pray from a feeling of abundance, we're creating the feeling that we're wishing to achieve, and it gets mirrored back to us by the achievement. If we pray from a sense of lack or scarcity, we are praying with that feeling, and that gets mirrored back to us also. Those are some important implications that this DNA experiment tends to support. And there were some other experiments done by the U.S. Army Intelligence and Security Command called ENSCOM. This was reported in Santa Fe also in 1993 in a journal called Advances Volume 9, and the author was Jay Motz. And he took DNA from donors, placed the DNA in another room in the same building, and then the donor was shown violent videos or images of humor. So when they were shown this, the DNA, you know, went through conformational changes, but it went through the changes without a time lag. So it was instant. One of the designers of this experiment happened to be Cleve Baxter, who was the individual who hooked up plants to polygraphs and reported on those effects back in 1974 in a book called The Secret Life of Plants. And he was one of the designers, and he carried the experiment a little bit further and showed that there was no time lag of effect at a 300-mile distance. So the conclusion we might draw from this is that when we have an emotional response, our cells can communicate through this non-local energy field that exists everywhere all the time. And the cells communicate with the world around us, and that time and distance are inconsequential on the communication effect. So if you take all these three experiments together, we can sort of summarize a conclusion that we can select a belief or attitudinal shift that will allow a sort of a karmic wheel or a code of conduct in our lives that has a direct effect on our cellular health, and that human emotions produce effects that defy conventional limits of space-time or electromagnetism. Now, there's a fourth experiment, which is really not an experiment. It's more of a research project. And I'm not going to do it justice, so I'm going to refer the listener to the book that it's reported in called The God Code by this religious scholar, the spiritual scholar Greg Braden, who goes about with these rather fantastic presentations that he give. I just saw him in Santa Fe, and he reported on this particular project that he's been engaged with for 12 years as a research project that involves rabbis and microbiologists and geneticists and linguists and statisticians. And the research project uses a second century science called gematria to correlate number and letter relationships in core root alphabets, such as Hebrew, Arabic, Sanskrit, cuneiform, Latin, and Greek. And these number and letter relationships are correlated with atomic mass number of hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, and carbon. And these are the four elements that are that form the base pairs. These four elements are in the base pair sequencing of DNA, so cytosine, thymine, adenine, and guanine. And the atomic mass number is linked to letters in the Hebrew alphabet to yield a certain type of code that then is read into the base pair sequencing and into the genetic code. This is where I won't be able to explain what he so elegantly explained with his images and with his erudition. But the essence of the research, which has been sanctioned and approved of and given the blessings by these top rabbis, is that the cytosine, the thymine, the adenine, and the guanine have an encoded kind of message, as if the creator of this DNA was putting the creator's own personal mark or signature on it. And the word that comes forward is YHVG. That's a terminology that stands for the Hebrew term Yahweh, which is a sacred sound that was deleted about 6,800 times from the ancient Torah. But the first, before these deletions of Yahweh occurred in the Torah, there was found in the caves of Qumran on the Dead Sea, in cave 4, there was a lot of fragments that were found, just fragments of papyrus and writings and little pieces of paper. And one of these fragments contained these words, YHVG, which basically mean God eternal within the body. So the sacredness and the secretness of the word Yahweh is one that this particular author is researching. And peoples of the Jewish Hebrew tradition would say that it's secret because no one knows what the word sounds like, because it's just consonants, YHVG. And the consonants tend to create a separation or dissociation, and the vowels are what create the sound of the word. So this gets into just some fantastic information. So I refer the listener to Greg Braden's book called The God Code.
What's the name of the book, John?
The God Code.
God Code.
The God Code by Greg Braden. He wrote another book called The Isaiah Effect, and he is an excellent speaker about the extraordinary information which has been found in the Dead Sea Scrolls that is really just now beginning to come out. These scrolls were discovered in a period of time between 1946 and 49, and all of these massive amounts of information which survived time, it's about 2,500 fragments. They were printed on papyrus and animal hide and copper. We have been put together in 900 scrolls, but it was done by a group of seven men or patricians. They didn't have a woman in the group. So,
very interesting. Are you ready to open for questions?
Yes.
All right. Kevin.
Fred, anybody that has a question, go ahead and hit star one.
Okay, it's going to take a minute or so to queue up and get ready, and you'll know when you're on.
Okay. They may not want to ask me any questions.
John Day's ready for you.
I may have scared them away.
I don't think so. Interesting stuff, John.
Well, people think if they want to ask questions, one thing we didn't cover was this: the most important relationship that the human being experiences is the relationship. It's kind of where we started this talk. It was we were talking about my mother, and so this relationship that we each have to the mother is really the most essential one, because it's in the intrauterine environment, and it's in the perinatal experience, particularly in the first day of life, in the first 24 hours, the maternal infant bonding allows the organism to be set as to whether it's going to have a more of a predisposition to dysautonomia or wild swings in parasympathetic and sympathetic activity, or is going to be more confident and well-grounded in its ability to stand inside of self through traumas that come. And when we're well-grounded and can stand in self, then it's easy to follow the message of the heart instead of letting the left brain override. So it's now well correlated through trauma science that the development of the right prefrontal cortex is the key event, and this occurs in those first contact moments with the mother. And when the right prefrontal cortex is developed, then the connection of brain communicating to right prefrontal cortex can happen with an ease that allows that information to be transported across the diencephalon nuclei and the corpus callosum into the left hemisphere, where it can be kind of correlated into a life response. So the left hemisphere should be saying, okay, right brain, you listen to heart, you tell me what heart says, and I'll go figure out the game plan, because that's my style, that's my way. This is really dependent on maternal infant bonding at its core, and therefore how we respond to trauma events.
Well, that makes me think of a few things, but we do have a question, so we're going to go ahead and take it, John, okay?
Okay.
Hi, it's Paula. I'm familiar with what you're talking about because I've been through this experience with systemic lupus and actually got rid of it in many of the ways that you're describing. And my question is this. I recently had a discussion with Jack Chalom. Are you familiar with his Feed Your Genes?
I'm sorry, the name again?
Jack,
I can't Chalom. Hear you quite well.
I think his name is Jack Chalom.
Jack Chalom. I don't know Jack Chalom.
Now, one of the things that he was talking about was that in the DNA coding and reversing the imbalances that happen generationally, he was talking about after second generation mutation, for lack of a better word, that when you got into the third and fourth stages, that he was finding scientifically it was irreversible. Can you comment on that?
I think anything is reversible. The issue with DNA is that DNA sort of orders the organization versus the chaos of cells, if you will. In the chaos of life, we tend to work through fear-based emotions, creating cycles of fear, guilt, shame, quitting, denying, blaming, and all of this that relate to trauma events. I think that the DNA element can be healed basically, as I was saying, through a resolution of trauma and through coming out of brain mind into heart mind. We stay up in brain mind because our traumas aren't resolved, and we stay inside of the judge, the critic, the skeptic, and the pusher, which is all left brain construct and lexicon. This is going to keep any kind of mutation or abnormal DNA sequencing present. But healing out of that into organized, coherent, love-based emotion states, I believe, is the power to heal anything. I think that's the essence of all great healers, is that they have owned that so well that they're able to transmit that experience to the recipient. But the real issue for all of us is that the land of healing lies within. It's radiant with happiness, and it's sort of madly pursued in 1,000 outer directions. So the scriptural issue that's brought up, I think, maybe in the book of Exodus or Deuteronomy, is that the sins of the fathers shall be visited on 7 generations. I think that's true behaviorally. I tend to see that. We tend to take on our traumas from our parents and visit that chaos down through the line. But it's can be healed through the self-aware practice of forgiveness, non-judgment, and unconditional presence. I don't believe that it's not able to be healed. Those are my comments.
Thank you. I totally agree.
Good. Thank you for the question.
John, it's really important to try to just listen and not judge.
Well, the issue with judgment basically comes back to an ownership phenomenon. We do judgment because we judge self. We can't give away what we don't own, so we own this judgment of self, and therefore that's kind of what we find ourselves doing. It's a pure left brain construct, but it's highly dependent on unresolved trauma events and not coming into forgiveness. In relationship, which I seem to work with a lot over here, in relationship work, I talk about person A, that's you, person B, that's other, and then there's the third entity, which is the relationship itself. And the third entity is what I call a common neutral ground. It should be a place where other makes it safe for you to enter and you make it safe for other to enter, and that's the ideal. And we do this by practicing forgiveness as the first step. And forgiveness is really just a simple decision to acknowledge the pure essence of another being and not acknowledge their personal history, their personal trauma, their ego, their faults, and all their quirks. We're just trying to acknowledge a pure essence. We're not clairvoyants. We're not seers. And we don't have any special kind of psychic powers. It's just a simple decision to acknowledge that this being with you has a pure essence. And that's going to make it a lot easier to own non-judgment. So we have to kind of do this with our own self, acknowledge that our own self is of pure essence, and to not own so much judgment of self. It's a practice. It's a daily practice. So that's one of those choice points on the daily now time practice along a horizontal timeline, just practicing one day at a time, owning non-judgment.
John, I'm going to do a little summary because we're going to end soon, and tell me if this needs to be corrected, but I think you're saying that our attitudes can affect our cells, can affect our DNA, and all can be healed if we can forgive, and perhaps we may not even know what it is exactly that we're forgiving or exactly what the trauma is, but it still can all be healed.
Yes. Yes, it all can be done by the practice of forgiveness and non-judgment and self-love. So I tried to put this model together to kind of keep us all on course, mostly me, so I've got to try to own this too, help people have it. But all of the cellular structuring is, of course, ordained out of DNA. And there's a lot of mystery about DNA that we're just beginning to scratch the very surface of. But it's the all-important molecule that we try to feed and keep healthy and so that the order of the cell is correct.
John, you mentioned Lauren Cordain tonight, and I'm not even sure if you know this, but I want our audience to know that exactly 2 weeks from tonight, our guest is Dr. Lauren Cordain, author of The Paleo Diet, and coming out soon is his new book, The Paleo Diet for Athletes. And he is a really interesting gentleman, as John knows, and that's on May 25th. And then next week, please join us for Dr. Eva Quinar, an endocrinologist who's going to talk about the thyroid weight loss connection. Very busy practice in California where she does a lot of weight loss and obviously a lot of medical testing for hormones and thyroid, et cetera. So that should be a really great call. John, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And I really appreciate you being here, and we've kept you a long time. We actually do have one more question if you want to take it.
I'd like that, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Linda,
okay,
for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Good, good, good. We enjoyed having you.
I'd like to know where could get more information on the system you just outlined. It's very intriguing, and intuitively it seems very right to me.
Yeah, I appreciate those words. I think it's really, I don't mean to sound glib, but it's inside of you. It's inside of the heart.
Well,
now, I have a simple website. It's called www.halenlifestream.com. Halen is spelled H-A-E-L-A-N. There's not much that you get from the website except a little bit of a description about the process and how you can get in touch with me. I have not written anything about this, but then again, there's nothing that I've said tonight that's truly original. It's all been said before in all of these books, from all of these traditions, from all of these current and past scientific thinkers. And so all I tried to do was put it into a format where we could kind of move toward the heart.
Mm-hmm.
The most important aspect is studying any kind of spiritual tradition, which is all of the good ones, that stress self-love,
mm-hmm.
moving into the heart consciousness, silence there, that aspect of mindfulness.
It's where all healing starts.
It is. It is where all healing starts. It's the land of healing that lies within, radiant with happiness that's blindly sought in 1,000 outer directions, as one of the great seers of the last century said.
Well, that is a great ending, Dr. John Day. Thank you, everybody, for joining us tonight, and we hope that you'll join us again next Wednesday night for Design Spirals Clinical Rounds with Dr. Eva Quinar on thyroid and weight loss. Okay, everybody, thank you so much. Thanks, John. That was
awesome.
Thank
you, Linda. Thank you, listeners.
Good
night.
Good night, everybody.